If you do not have a validated tap card, you may be subject to penalties.
It's not Compton, what's up, punk? It's South Central, a crime wave of gangster made criminals.
South Central Los Angeles, in mainstream media and in the minds of those who don't work or live here, is often branded by the violent and chaotic flashpoints in its history.
South Central Rooted will demonstrate that these events were culminations of the generations of institutional neglect and exploitation that precedes them. Although some of the conditions changed, this legacy still affects South LA residents in all aspects of their daily lives, from housing and employment to transportation, policing, and the environment.
Yeah, we don't want to do anything to scare your children. That's the last thing we want to do.
After the 92 civil unrest, many promises were made both nationally and locally to invest in infrastructure, particularly economic development in South Central LA. Nearly 30 years later, movement leaders and community organizations have been tirelessly working to ensure that community is not only represented in these decisions, but that they are incorporated in these initiatives in order to add to the investment in their community, as well as the community's talent.
COVID-19, the national uprisings across the country last year, and efforts to reopen and begin the process of recovery have only brought to the surface the need for investment in South Central LA's future if it's to recover and thrive. In our upcoming webinar, Investing in South LA's Future Through Economic Development, we will talk to movement builders in the community about the importance of investing in South LA talent and also discuss the workforce initiatives currently in the works that can tremendously impact South LA's economic, workforce, and business development. Welcome, everyone. Good morning, and thank you all for joining us today. This webinar is called Investing in South LA's Future Through Economic Development. I'm Marlo Jenkins, born and raised in Compton, California, and surrounded by revolutionaries. I was politicized at an early age. I am one of the founding members of South Central Youth, empowered through action, informally called Say Yeah, Community Coalition's youth organizing component. I developed professionally by amazing mentors like Congresswoman Karen Bass and Councilmember Marquise Harris Dawson. I spent a number of years honing my strategic marketing skills in New York City, but I returned home to South LA with strong social capital, which I now use to make real change in my community. Fun fact, I coached high school cheerleading competitively at my alma mater, Locke High School, for 23 years. Elmer.
Hi, everyone. Thank you, Marlo, for that introduction. My fun fact, I'll start with that, and that is that Marlo and I have been lifelong friends and colleagues in the movement. We met each other as young members of Community Coalition and have continued to do similar work. Even though our paths have gone in different directions, we continue to work together. I am the executive director of Communities in Schools of Los Angeles. It's an organization that provides case management and other social emotional support to students in 13 schools across 5 communities in the LA Unified School District. And I'm very happy to be here today. I'm a lifelong resident of South LA myself. Went to school at LA Unified. I have 2 sons, one who graduated from LA Unified and at UC Irvine, and the other one who is a 9th grader attending school in Oakland. And I'm very excited to be here. We're very proud co-hosts of the South Central Rooted podcast. It is produced by the South LA Building Healthy Communities Collaborative, which has many great organizations that come together to look at issues in South Los Angeles, but more importantly, to look at solutions to those problems. The podcast is based on the report called South Central Rooted. It's a beautifully designed, well put together report. If you all are inclined to read the report and hear previous episodes of this podcast, you can find them all on the southlaisthefuture.org website. And the report is laid out in a way where it helps us understand the way that racist policies manifest in every aspect of the way that South LA residents are impacted by economic investment.
In the report and in the podcast, we discuss four key drivers of disparity, as Elmer mentioned, those four being gentrification, displacement, and homelessness. The second being poverty, disinvestment, and joblessness. The third being policing, suppression, deportation, and mass incarceration. And last being environmental racism. The podcast and the report combine history, data, and the voices of residents and local community leaders and organizers. They help us understand how Black and Brown communities on the front line of systemic racism are the ones leading the way towards transformative change. We realize that these conversations and political education tools are important in our current moment, and we face a collective reckoning with the legacy of white supremacy and anti-Black racism in our society. Today, we want to talk about how nearly 30 years after the 92 civil unrest, COVID-19, the national uprising across the country last year, and efforts to reopen and begin the process of recovery have only brought to the surface the need for investment in South Central LA's future if it is to recover and thrive. The purpose of today's webinar is to discuss with community leaders on the ground the importance of investing in South LA talent, and also discuss the workforce initiatives currently in the works that can tremendously impact South LA economic development, workforce development, and business development. Let's start by introducing our panelists. Benjamin Benny Torres is the president and CEO of Community Development Technology Center, which is known as CD Tech, nonprofit organization focused on addressing issues of racial equity and economic justice. CD Tech supports residents to fight for systems change and resource development opportunities while preparing those same communities to take advantage of the change and opportunities they generate. Benny also serves as president of City of LA Commission on Community and Family Services and on the LA County Public Health Equity Task Force Commission. Welcome, Benny.
Next, we have Adele Syed. He's a chief executive officer of UMA Clinic. Adele Syed holds a master's in public policy and administration from Northwestern University, a bachelor's in political science from UC Davis, and is currently completing his doctorate in organizational leadership. Adele is a 2011 fellow at the New Leaders Council, a nonpartisan organization that engages a diverse national network of political entrepreneurs. He is a Rockwood Leadership Institute fellow. He participated in that program in 2013, and a Rockwood Leadership Institute lead and a now California fellow. He did that program in 2019. Adele also completed the Blue Shield of California Foundation Clinic Leadership Institute Emerging Leaders Program. That's a mouthful. I hope that's written on a plaque somewhere, and the plaque is huge, in huge font. He's the on the board of directors of the Southside Coalition of Community Health Centers and the Community Clinic Association of Los Angeles County. Welcome, Adele. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
And last but certainly not least, we have Zahira Mann. Zahira Mann leads Slate Z, a place-based initiative and collective impact effort whose mission is to revitalize South Los Angeles by moving residents to economic opportunity. She leads the South Los Angeles Promise Zone, which has over 70 local partners and is a part of a 22-member Promise Zone network that addresses systemic poverty in urban, rural, and tribal communities across the nation. Zahira splits her career between philanthropy and law. She is a senior program officer. She was a senior program officer at the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, and United Way of Greater Los Angeles. Before entering philanthropy, Zahira worked as a public interest attorney, representing and advising for not-for-profit and nonprofit entities, coalitions, and governmental agencies on large-scale systemic issues that impacted families, youth, and businesses. In her broader civic life, Zahira serves as a commissioner on the State Bar of California's Legal Services Trust Fund Commission and as an alternate commissioner on the California Coastal Commission. Wow. Welcome. Can you tell us a little more about the current state of healthcare jobs and opportunities in South LA?
Just a quick background to contextualize a little bit about UMA's work and how it's come about. As a community health center rooted in South Los Angeles, our locations are only in South Los Angeles. UMA's history came out from the uprising in the early 1990s, where a group of medical students sought to make a difference in the community and worked hand in hand with many of the pioneers we see in South LA today to really create UMA. So UMA started as a social justice organization that became a clinic. We never started as a clinic that just sought to do social justice. And so I think that's important because that has always been the underpinnings of how we've thought about the services we provide, the type of engagement we'd like to build with the community, and empowering our communities to take charge of their own lives and to raise and build healthy families in South Los Angeles. And I think during the last 18 months, during this pandemic, we've seen some of the same inequities that the report highlights. And I really suggest everyone take a look at the report and looking at specifically some of the root causes of everything. And if you kind of create a funnel, all of these kind of lead to health inequities at a larger state. And when I'm speaking with funders or stakeholders, they say, you know, what can we do to help improve the health? And my first response is create more workforce opportunities and uplift the community's development in jobs and workforce development overall. And so to go to the question specifically, I think we've seen Black and Brown communities take the brunt of not only the impact of COVID-19 in communities in terms of infection rates. And why is that happening? Because essential workers also means being at higher exposure risks to COVID-19 overall. And so I think when we talked about working from home, people don't often realize that that's a luxury to have, and that the same essential workers that are on the ground are from and in Black and Brown communities serving the community and putting their own lives at stake on the front lines. And we've seen that with increased rates of infections across the board as well. So as a health center, what we've really focused on, one, knowing and understanding that over 75% of our staff comes from right here in South LA. And that means that when the pandemic hit, our first things that we had to put in place, aside from the health orders, was taking care of our community and our staff. So that meant extra food at UMA, a food pantry that staff could come take food from with no questions asked. Help with childcare if that was needed, because our staff were on the front lines of serving sick community members. And so these are the things that I think we have to think through in terms of positioning a workforce that's from and within South LA to really thrive, and not only survive, but thrive and serve the community on a daily basis, because they're serving their neighbors, they're serving their church leaders, they're serving everyone in the community. And to be able to take care of them first and foremost is great. And I think what we've been able to do through Southside Coalition of Community Health Centers, which is an umbrella organization of roughly 8 health centers that specifically serve South Los Angeles, and the important work in terms of understanding this, the unique needs of the South LA community, and being able to understand and address those needs in a health mindset that also understands the other social determinants of health. And one of those is obviously workforce development and creating pipelines for workforces. So we've seen a shift both in terms of hiring, both in terms of building up a workforce. And for us, it's not that we hire our workforce at a certain level, but we want to make sure that they have different levels that they can build up. So for example, for hiring a medical assistant, we want to make sure there's a pathway for them to become an LVN or licensed vocational nurse. We want to know that we can provide tuition assistance to them as an organization so they can go to school to become a nurse practitioner, or whatever the career path that they'd like to take on. And I think hiring employees and working in South LA and coming with that context really not only creates for an atmosphere of, I think, workplace of choice, but also in terms of serving our patients. So those are some of the things that we're doing.
Great. Benny, I want to ask you about City Tech. And, you know, City Tech has been an institution in South Los Angeles for as long as I can remember. And your organization works to bolster not only the nonprofit sector, but more importantly, to invest in South LA residents and their leadership. And I'd love for you to talk about those two.
Well, thank you once again for inviting me to participate. And thanks to the South LA BHC for all the work that we've all been doing collectively, but particularly for the folks that are leading developing these initiatives to really have conversation. So it's important to provide some context, right? So when we think about the nonprofit sector, and think of it, all of us here in this call are in the nonprofit sector. So we're all getting paid to do something we're passionate about, we care about, our politics align with the work that we do. How fortunate are we that this is the kind of work that we get to do, as opposed to the work that maybe our parents did, that they hated to go to work, but they had to pay the bills, right? So it's important to understand the context of this is passion-driven work. This is work that not only helps change communities, but it feeds the soul. So I'll say that it's important to understand the context of nonprofits and why we need to continue to invest in not only the sector, but the workforce. It's the fourth largest economy in the state of California. It's the easiest kind of entry-level opportunity to enter because of the fact that experience, life experience matters in terms of your ability to enter a nonprofit that's doing services in a local community. It's also a nonprofit, the industry is a nonprofit sector is also aging out in terms of white leadership, white executive leadership. So there's opportunities for transforming the leadership direction of many of these nonprofits. When I think about the impact that nonprofits have, you not only help transform people's individual lives by giving them something to focus on that's substantive and transformative, but you're also investing in transforming the local community and strengthening the safety net that exists in the area. It's important that we invest and stabilize nonprofits, grow them so that more resources enter the sector. So many of the efforts that you see happening right now at the federal level, state, county, right? We're talking about $1.9 billion coming to the county, $1 trillion for infrastructure. We have Measure W, Measure M, many of the measures that were advocated by nonprofits to generate opportunities. We have to make sure we position people to take advantage of those opportunities. And the nonprofit sector is one way to do that. Because of the fact that we're trying to strengthen the sector and create more job opportunities to actually even go deeper into more marginalized neighborhoods, it also helps us then think about how do we create a leadership worker base that can then enter that field, right? That understands why you're entering the nonprofit sector. Remember, nonprofits range from the social service providers all the way to the direct action community organizing groups. These are all, this is entire nonprofit sector. And it's important that we bring together that sector and have more communication and dialogue to develop collective strategies to impact areas like South Los Angeles. And then at the same time, think about how do we invest in building the future managers, executive leaders of these nonprofits by starting with paid internship opportunities, bringing together different resources from the federal government, as well as creating local resource opportunities with philanthropy, as well as county and city governments, and tapping into the existing programs that exist, but making sure we create pipeline opportunities so that people are going, and these pipeline opportunities are designed to meet people where they're at. And you're going from one program to the next program, but with a paid resource. So just like we invest in apprenticeship programs in the construction trades, we need to do the same in the nonprofit sector. So that's what we've been doing at City Tech for now 20 some years. It requires a combination of different pieces, right? So you have to work with the nonprofit sector to figure out what are they looking for in terms of employer leaders, right? What are the skills, the knowledge sets, the kind of networks that they want people to bring, what kind of lived experience and what kind of academic preparation along with work experience do we need, are we looking for? And once we can figure that out and we can develop these pipeline programs that focus on training, coaching, mentoring, and placement, that's also intentional about who you recruit. So that we're making sure that we're getting Black and Brown folks from South LA into the sector in a manner to really strengthen our communities and change the economic conditions long-term by creating what you said earlier, which was civically engaged, worker-ready people who are making a lifetime commitment to transformative systemic change.
Zahira, Can you please tell us about the work of Slate Z's Collaborative and what you all are doing around economic development and workforce initiatives?
And thank you so much for having me here today. It's really an honor to be in this space with all of you. So at Slate Z, our mission is focused on economic revitalization of South LA. And we primarily do this by serving as the facilitating organization for the South LA Promise Zone, which is, as an effort, part of a broader 22 network Promise Zone that is throughout the country in urban, rural, and tribal communities, and they're all focused on poverty. So it's really understanding poverty from the perspective of what's happening in these very different communities that have different demographics, but we all have a core part of issue that we're all dealing with. Our Promise Zone has a 10-year implementation period, so we're about halfway through it with 5 more years to go. And the model, the entire model, is really focused on leveraging resources, and it's something that's called a collective impact approach. Essentially, what that means is that we have a common agenda, so we all want the same thing. We use data, so we use information and numbers to be able to track and understand whether or not we're making progress towards our collective goals. We're constantly communicating because when you have a collaborative of people, we all need to know what the others are doing in order to make sure that we're still all moving in the same direction. We have collaborative and connect activities. So there are things that once you piece them together, they create a whole. So that we can have these really holistic, comprehensive solutions as we're working on addressing change. And it's all facilitated by an organization, which is Slate Z. So we're bringing together all of those pieces as part of our effort. We have over 70 partners who are part of that effort, and we cover not all of South LA, but a very specific 5-mile area. That's roughly bounded by some of the light rail lines. And there are about 200,000 residents within that area. And if you kind of take that specific slice of South LA and put it within the context of California, and if we just took those numbers, we would be in the top 25 of cities in California, which has about 1,400 cities within it. So it's still a pretty dense area. It's a pretty comprehensive area. And we're really digging in to ensure that we see change within South LA. And the effort of working with so many different partners who are coming from government, elected officials, nonprofits, the broader private sector businesses and residents is to ensure that level of transformational change. And within that transformational change, there are 5 levers of change that we're focused on. Transit and mobility, so that people can move around the area and outside of it. Education in terms of preparing for workforce especially. Local business support and community infrastructure that helps with the level of economic revitalization, living wage jobs for that stability, and then also public safety to ensure that the community is safe and you have that level of community cohesion. With workforce and local business support specifically, there are a number of projects that then fall under all of those efforts. I've shared with you this fairly comprehensive and holistic that's happening within this 5-mile area. But part of what we're looking at in terms of, for example, jobs is researching to understand so we know what the jobs are of the future. And that's what we're training people to do so that our community in South LA and like as we're comparing it and sharing it with other communities around the country, that low-income communities and communities of color are prepared for the jobs of the future can for those within the first tier, and those end up being stable, sustainable jobs for families. We're also developing apprenticeship programs. You know, as Benny was sharing in terms of some of the pieces with nonprofits, it also exists with construction jobs and with others to ensure that there's a pipeline and a pathway for entering into these jobs. And then also in terms of small businesses. So small businesses, when you think about local businesses in a local economy, some of the economies and communities that are stronger, a dollar circulates longer within the community, which means that you have businesses to go to, that you're actually investing on a regular basis, the money that you're getting from your job within your actual community, which means that we need to have strong local businesses in order for you to have entities that you're patronizing, which not only provide employment support, but they provide economic support to the community and allow for that dollar to circulate. So we're providing training to small businesses so that they are also strong and stable, and then they can compete for other things like contracts with cities and counties that help to further the efforts in terms of the small businesses. So all of these efforts in terms of economic revitalization are fairly comprehensive, but we have a lot of partners at the table, including residents who are working to move all the efforts forward.
Great. Thank you for that. I want to open it up now to both Adele and Zahira. And you know, I'd love for you to paint a picture for us and describe what a healthy economy and a healthy workforce looks like, specifically for South Los Angeles. Adele, I'll start with you.
You know, I think one, we have to start with a living wage. And I think, you know, as LA County continues to increase, what we define as minimum wage is not really, it's a farce, right? We need to pay a living wage. And I think as an organization, you know, UMA is committed to our frontline workers making a living wage. So meaning that a one income individual can support themselves in terms of housing, in terms of all the other basic necessities and living. And oftentimes what happens is that a living wage far outpasses everything that's happening external in an economy. And so it makes it difficult for organizations, especially nonprofit organizations, I would argue, to be able to keep up and pay that. But I think a workforce that is paid well is first and foremost. And I think secondarily, the needs of that workforce also being taken care of. And so, as I mentioned earlier, during the pandemic, right, we understood that there is a lot of food scarcity amongst staff, amongst their families, amongst their extended families that are living with them. So understanding the family dynamics of staff, of their extended families, of the community at large was really important. And I think when you address those needs, you begin to really bring to the surface the other psychosocial needs that need to be met to build a really strong workforce. And to that end, you know, we partnered with LA Food Forward to do a free farmers market at our Fremont High School location that now on a monthly basis provides 30,000 pounds of fresh fruits and vegetables to the local community that anyone can come take from. And we have 18 other partner organizations that come and take from that. And we did that because that came from the community's needs, right? We heard from the community saying, these things are important. We heard from staff as well, but they said we need access to food. And obviously being well-positioned in a food desert, we knew that access was important. And so it was really coalescing these organizations to address some of these other psychosocial needs and basic necessities to build a strong workforce.
You know, I would echo what Adele shared. I think all of that is exactly right in terms of the different elements. I want to pick up a little bit on the thread related to the family and the family structure, is that that's a key piece as well, is really thinking about what are, as Adele shared, like what are the needs of the full family? And so that's why as part of our efforts in terms of a collaborative, you know, we're focused on education, which part of that education are pathways into future workforce opportunities. And we have connections with schools and the community college. But it's also then the parents as well. So we're talking about the children and like what their lives are gonna look like, the parents and the types of jobs that they're entering into, and really whoever else is within the household who needs to have that level of stability. And then it radiates out in terms of what supports that family, what supports that children. That is the entire infrastructure of the community and looking at what that entire infrastructure of the community needs. I spoke a little bit about small businesses and being able to have that support for small businesses, but there's other community infrastructure that we also think about and are discussing. So part of that may be green space. You know, what is the green space that is needed for families to be well? This in South LA, and especially the part that we're looking at as part of Slate Z, in terms of the environmental measures, it's one of the most polluted parts of California. And so as families are existing and going about their everyday experience, where are the spaces that they have for a level of respite, you know, just to be in a green space? But then what are the other pieces that are going to help to offset some of that pollution that they're also experiencing? And so these are also spaces where when we think about a healthy economy and a healthy workforce is that as we look towards really what is a greening of our economy more broadly from a California perspective, but then also as the federal government continues to think about infrastructure and green measures, how do we pour that into communities that have experienced a lot of environmental injustice? How do we start to offset some of that so that they have the spaces for respite as well as having some of the things that are going to help to mitigate the impacts that have been experienced over the years. And you know, the last thing that I'll say with this, and I was sharing those five different elements of work that we look at in terms of, you know, transit and economic activity, jobs, education, public safety. All of those in terms of the interrelationship to them is how do we start to really think about children and families in this really holistic way of what are the all the other aspects that they need. Because even if you're able to help family members secure a job, how are they gonna get to that job? What's gonna happen with their children? What are the outcomes for their children? What do we need to ensure that the entire family is healthy? And doing all of those things at exactly the same time. And that's what this particular moment in time calls for. This is what we've always needed. But I think we're at the space where, as we think about healthy economies and healthy workforce, we really can ask for all of the investments that we need at exactly the same time, rather than having them staggered in the hopes that they'll start to catch up to each other.
That's beautiful. Thank you both. I'd like to ask Sahira again, what does it mean to you to invest in South LA talent and invest in creating opportunities for South LA residents?
The two pieces that really come to mind for me in terms of South LA talent and South LA businesses are two terms that we often use within the environmental space, but I'm gonna use them to mean two different things. So I wanna use it both in the environmental context, but also in a common broader context. And the two words that I really wanna focus on are sustainability and resiliency. So in terms of sustainability, when we talk about ensuring that we have the different pieces and opportunities for families and for children, what are the elements that are sustainable, that really are spaces where we can dig in and help with a level of growth and thriving that comes with that level of sustainability? Our workforce has changed dramatically over the decades. And that's not just for low-income communities, that's for every single community. I've worked with so many students over the years where I'll have conversations with them, and their vision of work is what their parents, who might be very high income earners, what their vision of work was that you go into a company when you're whatever age old and you leave maybe 30 years later. And that is your entire work cycle, that's your entire experience. And that's just not the reality of work anymore. And so I think that as we're having these conversations about work, it's being honest about what the reality of work is. And the reality of work is that you take a set of skills and you use them in a lot of different contexts. And so I think that part of this means in terms of investing means that some of the systems that we have in place need to rethink them. So for example, when we think about workforce centers and workforce, career counseling within those spaces so that individuals know how you take the experience that you gained, whether you were working as an apprentice for a construction trade, or whether you were working to go into a position to become a typist, there's a transferable element of that skill set that can be used in a different position, even if it has a different title. And so being able to help people with that level of in-depth case management, which is more intensive, but it also means that when you start to see these different levels of certificates that say, okay, here is an added level of skill, someone can see themselves in that because they know that, you know, I did all the training for this one position, but that's not the end for me. I can do a little bit more training and I can get this other position, which may be twice as much money. But you have to first see yourself as being in that other stage. And so I think being able to provide communities really comprehensive understanding of what our workforce actually is today, what it takes to navigate around the workforce in and out of positions. And having that piece that allows for that level of sustainability, which then leads to this other piece in terms of like a level of resiliency. So that level of resiliency of knowing that you have multiple skills, knowing you have multiple tools and multiple experiences to draw on helps communities in terms of their level of resiliency. But the other side of resiliency in terms of opportunities that serve the entire family is that we're also in this space that as we think about these issues, even from an environmental perspective, we're talking about how do we have communities that are resilient? What does climate resiliency look like? And as even we're thinking about those spaces, what are those spaces providing that are comprehensive hubs and comprehensive centers that really allow a level of what communities actually need to thrive beyond just a place that you go when there is weather that's been impacted because of climate change, but become spaces where they are nonprofit hubs and hubs of activity that you can go. And so when we think about sustainability and resiliency, let's broaden our scope of thinking that allows community members, allows families and children to make the best decisions for them, which means that they need a range of options and a range of opportunities, because we know that communities, that families know exactly what they need. The only thing missing is the opportunities to execute it and the resources available to execute it. And so I think that that's in terms of creating opportunities, it's giving communities exactly what they need in order to make decisions that are going to be best for them. And they will always choose things that are going to be sustainable and resilient for them, for their specific family. But it's harder if we try to tell them what that is, because every family, it's going to be different in terms of what they need.
I wanted to just jump in there. Thank you, Sahira, for that. Just to say that, you know, the skill building piece, right, and the knowledge sets that you gain, for example, in the nonprofit sector, cut across into government, into the public sector, and they cut across into the private sector. You know, there's more of an interconnection now between these sectors than there's ever been. And so it's important to understand that those skill sets are critical. The other thing that's important that was mentioned by Sahira is this idea of don't recruit for a project or a program. Recruit for a lifestyle. Recruit for a transformative change opportunity. Recruit for what it means for the community, so that you're seeing yourself in a long-term trajectory and that you're understanding that you're making contributions, but you're learning along the way so you continue to kind of move up a social mobility kind of scale within your organization or within the job that you choose to do. Also begin to think about things from the type of wages we want to bring into our community, the kind of jobs we want to bring in, and really look at this from a regional perspective where everybody can participate regardless of where you live, race, ethnicity, gender, that you can engage in an economy that's created to address the conditions that are affecting your very same neighborhoods that you're a part of. I think that's important to continue to push for these kind of opportunities. When we talk about climate change, not everything has to be around construction, right? There's so many other parts of climate change that must be addressed where the community has experience and with skills like project management, community engagement and outreach, planning. When we talk about even planting of trees in communities like South LA that need more shade, big trees, sustaining those trees, communicating the need for that in the community, that's an entire career of work that you can do. And that's all available if we begin to think about this from a training and learning perspective.
Now, I want to add something real quick, if possible. You know, one example of that, thank you, Zahira and Benjamin, for that, was the promotoras, right? The health educators in the communities that I think early on, as health centers, there is a significant investment in. And I think in specifically urban communities, I think what has been realized that promotores are the ones, or, you know, the folks around the corner who can talk, you know, as a community health center, 51% of our board of directors come from the community we serve. So you can be sure that our board meetings, we're discussing things in terms of access to services as we are discussing the organizational budget. Right. So that comes with a level of discussion specifically with our patient board members that helps them realize not only how the nonprofit runs, as Benjamin was saying about just the intricacies of a nonprofit, but also their direct experiences of receiving services, right, through community partnerships, through exposure to, you know, someone who knows their community well enough to be at the local church or the local supermarket and other things. And I think when we look at something I think that's been talked about a little, but I'll point it out, how philanthropic dollars come into South LA and understanding how money is supporting or not supporting these projects, right? There's a recent study, and if you look at some of the work that's coming out of the Margaret E. Casey Foundation, and understanding that only 10% of philanthropic dollars go to organizations that are led and serve communities of color, right? And that's a problem. And if we don't address some of these historic injustices of how money is being allocated to what foundations think that needs to happen versus what's actually happening on the ground, we will be in the cyclical cycle of the wrong solutions being applied to the wrong problems. And so when you have community organizations that can uplift and really bring to the forefront of workforce development programs, right, to an organization that's going to be funding, that's a long-term investment. That's not a one-year budget cycle, right? That's a 5, 10, 15-year investment cycle. And I think foundations are now, and there are many great foundations out there and progressive-minded foundations, but for the ones that are inching their way up, right, those long-term investments is what's going to make the big change. And until we get folks to realize that at a philanthropic level, as many are, I think we're going to be in the cycle of really putting patchwork to some of these issues.
Did you want to add to that, Benny?
Yeah, well, there's a strong advocacy component to addressing issues of economic opportunity in South LA. I mean, you have nonprofits in South LA who are not even accessing public dollars. So they're just focused specifically on philanthropic dollars, which typically are good to start, but they're not very good for sustainability. So we have to continue to build on the pressure that was created by the Black Lives Matter movement in addressing historical racism in our systems, including the county, and how those public dollars, our dollars, do not get into our communities where the communities are most marginalized. So we have to push the county to change the way they do contracts with our community-based organizations. We have to make sure that the big nonprofits are working collaboratively with the smaller nonprofits in our community to make sure we strengthen the safety net and the resources that are available so that we're bringing more public dollars into our communities, which then generates to more jobs, which then helps stabilize the economic conditions of our community. We have to push and advocate for philanthropic dollars to come at higher rates and for more consistent amounts of time. Some people don't like the nonprofit sector because they feel like, well, you know, the pay is not very good. Well, it's a long game with the nonprofit structure. You know, it takes a long time to, yes, sometimes raise your salaries, but that's also because we're not forcing philanthropy to give us bigger dollars. So it's a combination of, yes, train the workforce. Yes, identify good industry opportunities for growth, but it's also about putting pressure and advocacy on policymakers and the county to bring these dollars into our communities. Look, economies are created by people who make decisions. If you don't believe that, just look at the state of California. In the 1920s and 30s in California, 1940s, the people who worked in the fields were not Latinos. They were not Mexicans. They were white folks who came from the Midwest. And the government in Sacramento said, what are we going to do for the children of these white folks who are now working in the fields to create a strong economy for California? Well, they created the defense industry. They created the South Bay. They created a finance industry. They created a real estate industry because they wanted the children of those farm workers to have a better opportunity to create a middle class. So what I'm trying to say here is the economy that you see in South LA is manufactured, and it can be changed if we advocate and organize collectively as organizations who provide services, organizations who do direct action. If we bring in the private sector and work with government, we can transform the economy of South LA. It takes intentionality, it takes political will, and it takes being prepared to not only advocate for programs and policies that generate opportunities, but it's also to train our community to be ready to meet those opportunities halfway.
I'm happy you said that, Benny, actually, because my next question was, how should we leverage this moment to strengthen the workforce pipelines? You know, that with the movement happening with the Black Lives Matter and, you know, all the other people being politicized, how should we leverage this moment to strengthen the workforce pipelines? And that's a question to all of you. Adele, Zahira?
I think that there's so much leveraging and so much opportunity that can happen right now, because there were already opportunities that were on, you know, top of mind for people. And then with COVID, it brought all of this in a more centered and focused way. But I think that the first way in terms of leveraging and strengthening the workforce pipeline right now is to really look at the pathways where we're going to be seeing growth. Those have changed since the pandemic. I think that there's been a little bit of a modification there. And so really understanding where are those spaces for growth and where are we going to see additional opportunity for communities? Where is there going to be money in terms of what's going to finance it? As you know, Benny was sharing, in terms of funding, sustainability really comes from those public dollars. And it takes a while for the public dollars to catch up. And we're now at this point where the infrastructure bill that we're looking at from the federal government, that didn't just happen because people were recently having conversations about that. That's decades in the making in terms of what's been built to create all of that, where we now not only have regulations, we have an entire marketplace that can now support that. And now it's about actually having the money and all the other pieces embedded within it. And it is something that is being looked at that's very different than past investments. So I think that really looking at those pathways for growth, childcare is another pathway for growth. You know, there's really, that has been something that has was already being worked on, especially at the local level with the county, but COVID and the pandemic has really shown a light in the fact that we need childcare. We need good childcare in this country in order to have a strong economy. So those end up being, you know, very different pathways. You know, I think also focusing on green technology and this whole greening of the economy that's occurring. Also focusing on the creative economy. I was just speaking with someone yesterday who was sharing in terms of all the construction that we're anticipating that there is a percentage there that then needs to go to arts. So public art in various forms. And even though the percentage, I believe it's like maybe 1%, sounds like a small percentage, when you're talking about large infrastructure projects and you're talking about construction, 1% on that amount of money is fairly significant. And so we also need to really think about what does our creative economy look like here? Because there are, going back to the conversation in terms of youth and families, there are going to be youth who are going to go into that space where they'll go into green technology or those pathways, they'll go into childcare, they're going to healthcare center. But then there are the others who want to become artists. And we now have funding that's available to them. And so let's continue to cultivate and promote our artists and help youth also see this connection in terms of how it can be this pathway in terms of work so that we're not shutting that out as an option. It is continues to be an option. It just looks a little bit different than what we thought it would look like before because it might be a pathway that's connected to construction. And then the piece that I mentioned earlier in terms of really having this level of like career counseling or case management as we think about the skill sets that individuals are able to cultivate for one position and being able to share what does that mean in terms of transferring it to another position. And I don't think that this is an issue that just exists within some of the way that we think about workforce today. I think it's really comprehensive across our society, this like, this misalignment in terms of understanding how you can take your skill set and transfer it into another position. Because youth, even when you're going into college, you may be going to get an engineering degree or you may be going to get an English degree. Understanding how you can take that same skill set and put it, use it in a job that doesn't have that same title requires some level of career counseling and requires some level of understanding how you reshape and rethink your resume and your story of self, and it's a narrative discussion. And so being able to do that, I think also helps with leveraging this particular moment because we have people who are ready. We have a community that is incredibly ready for this particular moment of investment. And the piece that is that we can really lean into is not only ensuring that those resources come to South LA, but ensuring that our community sees themselves in the opportunities that are coming to South LA so that everyone is exactly ready to apply, fully integrate into that work and to make it our own. Because that also, you know, Benny kind of just shared in terms of the farm workers, I think everyone, most people know that the culture of a space and the way a space operates is entirely dependent on people. And so even if you're looking at a green tech center right now that doesn't look like it reflects communities like South LA. Having people join that sector is what it will ensure that it reflects the community. And so the community first seeing themselves in it helps with that step. And then once people enter that space, it will change culture of the entire sector. And I think that that's something that we can leverage that we're entirely ready for, but it's about taking that next step to be able to enter that space within the economy.
I wanted to just quickly add as a kind of compliment to that. Thank you, Zahira. You know, at UMA, you know, we operate a wellness center on the campus of Fremont High School in South LA. And, you know, early on from the inception of that wellness center, you know, we knew that engagement on campus had to go above and, you know, knowing that there is a clinic on campus that students had access to. So we help initiate and start a student health leaders program where we engage freshmen to seniors in a years long kind of selection process where they become health ambassadors for the community, for their peers, and they learn a skill set over the summer. They do a mini public health school. You know, they get their peers to help interview and volunteer them. And most importantly, we actually pay them. They're on UMA's salary and staff. And so they're provided an economic mobility early on in their education, understanding, you know, the pathway for them, both in healthcare careers and community involvement. And most importantly, now we're trying to build that mentorship component that Zahira was talking about. And what we're doing is working with some of our medical students who are rotating with UMA and pairing them up and looking to pair them up with some of our Fremont students so they understand what that career pathway looks like for them, so they understand. And we've, in the past few years, hired students who have graduated from Fremont on UMA staff as they attend community college and, you know, transfer to a university so they can continue to build that workforce pipeline. And I think most importantly, other students on the campus of Fremont High School understand that, hey, healthcare careers are vast and varied. They go from health management, it goes to direct service, it goes to behavioral health support, it goes to a dental clinic that we're opening there. So they're both exposed to it, have peer support, and are valued and paid for their time in terms of their investment they're making back into their own communities.
I think we have to also think about how do we eliminate the barriers. I appreciate that Zahira mentions that you have to see yourselves in it, we have to get into these industries and we change the culture. But the thing is, we also have to eliminate the barriers that don't allow us to get into these kind of spaces, right? So if you look at the city and the county, they spend billions of dollars on procurement projects. How many Black-owned, how many Brown-owned companies are even registered with the city's procurement process or the county's procurement process? Think of the ports, think of the airport, think of all the millions and millions of dollars that come into these areas that if you had people of color-owned, women-owned companies connected, they would tend to hire maybe people that look like them, people that come from these similar communities, so that we would invest in our local infrastructure. So we have to begin to create easier pathways into these opportunities, eliminate the barriers that exist for businesses to enter, to get contracts, for workers in our community to access training. And once we get in, I mean, let's look at the construction industry. What happens with Black folks when they get hired? They get fired because of the racism and discrimination that happens on work sites. We don't talk about that. We talk about make sure let's get Black folks trained, let's get Black folks in. But we don't talk about how Black folks are not being sustained in some of these industries around construction. We don't talk about how some of these Latino workers are being exploited in some of these industries. And we blame the people, but we don't blame the employers, or we don't blame the people that are supposed to provide oversight and make sure that there's protections for these workers when we're talking about the construction industry, right? So we have to also make sure we're eliminating barriers, that we're creating strong pipelines, and that we're holding ourselves accountable. You know, the county of LA has about 37 workforce development training programs. The city of LA has our youth source, has our work source centers, has a, you know, business source centers. How are we making sure that those programs are including more folks so that we're building a stronger ecosystem to support, recruit, train, and place people that are going through that resource? You know, and how do we invest more dollars into these programs? Our family source centers, which I know very well because I'm on the commission that oversees them, need more dollars for two things. One, you hire more local people at these nonprofits and to help develop their skills, but you're also better serving the community by having people who are able to work with these residents, engage them in a very strong way, and also talk about community transformation, having a kind of collective understanding of what the North Star is. And here is not only, you know, helping to serve our communities and helping strengthen our safety net that we've seen was so dramatically needed during COVID and led by many nonprofits and activists. We're strengthening that, but we're also creating jobs to stabilize our areas and really create that opportunity for folks to develop the skills and grow within the nonprofit sector. So I think it's important that we think about that. And then it's important that we look at the public sector. You know, when we think about what strengthened the Black community in the 1970s and 80s, it was building public sector jobs, creating opportunities, eliminating the barriers of discrimination, right? Creating opportunities to get more folks in. We've seen the benefit of that. We saw when we deindustrialized Los Angeles and South LA, the impact it had on our community. So we have to make sure that we're looking at all three sectors, the public, private, and nonprofit sector, that we're looking at it regionally, which is create opportunity, think about the future, and really engage and connect people across the spectrum to make sure that we're thinking collectively and trying to have collective impact in terms of moving the economic needle around jobs, income, assets, and quality of life.
I felt like that was a bit of a mic drop. Thanks, Benny. You guys have been killing it so much that we have a lot of questions from the audience. But before we get into those, how can residents get involved in the work that you all are doing or find access to these resources right now?
I'll just jump in real quick because, you know, Zahira could talk about this too. But, you know, one of the things we're trying to do is give Slate Z an opportunity to really kind of show its value and its opportunity to bring folks across the table and think about how do we develop these pipeline pathway programs. So we have a South LA nonprofit apprenticeship program that we're starting this October. And if you want to learn more about it, you can go on the Slate Z website. You can go on the CD Tech website. It's targeting 18 to 25 year olds that are interested in the nonprofit sector. We're actually going to link them up with nonprofits that are part of the South LA community with an effort to really connect them to job training placed in the neighborhood. They get a $22,000 10-month stipend. They get access to $7,000 in education grants from the feds that they can use to continue their education. They're taking classes at LA Trade Tech in our Community Planning and Economic Development Department. They're doing work at a nonprofit, and they're also getting access to leadership development, coaching, and mentoring that could be really beneficial in their growth and development. That's just one example of a project that we've put together, and we're very excited about the collaboration. And we're hoping that this is something we can expand broader in South LA to reach more young people. But that's just one example of a project that's really tangible. If you're a nonprofit and you want to tap into the network and be a place where these young folks can learn their skills and their knowledge, you can also connect through the same website and have individuals placed at your nonprofit.
We've actually had two of those folks in previous iterations of that program, Benjamin. So thank you. And we've been able to hire them as full-time staff members at UMA. And we've been really able to have also supported their educational efforts even beyond UMA. So thank you, Benjamin. We've placed that. And to that end, you know, for UMA, I think, you know, we have opportunities to get involved. So if you'd like to become a patient of UMA and join our board, please do. And I know seldom, you know, we make pitches about who's going to join. I'm having an open call. You know, if you're interested in having a say in terms of the health and wellness and you live in South LA and you're inclined to maybe switch over as UMA as your healthcare provider, come join our board of directors. We have a really ambitious and growing number of board of directors. Or if that's a little bit too much of a commitment, we have board committees that you can serve on. If you've never served on the board, that's okay. We have training programs. You know, I walk through oftentimes before my board meetings, I have like a pre-board meeting of any open questions and answers for board members who maybe don't have as much experience. We're creating a board training curriculum. We need you on boards of directors. We need you on commissions. We need you to get trained to be able to speak on realities that we live in every single day. And to get to the boardrooms where those changes, where that change is happening, there's training grounds of nonprofits like UMA. So if you're involved, if you're inclined, please check out our website. If you want to be tapped into our student health leaders and the work that's happening on the Fremont campus, there's opportunities as well to be mentors and other things as well. So those are also available.
And I'll just add, so the apprenticeship program that Benny shared is a good example. And that's one of the pieces that we're doing within those five different efforts that's living underneath our jobs efforts as we think about apprenticeships and then other opportunities. So it's one of the projects. The other space I would say is that you could reach out to us is at info@slatez.org. We can share with you our newsletter. You can also go to our website, slatez.org. And then one of the pieces is that we work on a fair number of community engagement efforts or resident engagement efforts around large infrastructure projects. So we're working on one with the Baldwin Hills Conservancy right now. We'll be working on one with the LA Department of Transportation, talking about universal basic mobility around the area. So think, you know, those other options of mobility in addition to things like just clean transit. So, you know, bikes, electric vehicle charging, all of those sorts of things. But we'll be working with a group of residents to help understand some of those options. So that's another opportunity to engage in the organization. And, you know, just reach out to us and we'll talk about some other possibilities as well, because there are a number of different efforts that we're moving forward. So I mentioned transit. As we move forward over the next year or two, we're going to be working on fareless transit with Metro, which is how do we have fareless transit for K-12 students, but then also those who are living within affordable housing. And we're going to need residents as part of that effort, not only to help spread the word, but it's going to be implemented by residents. It's the K-12 students that implement it because they're the ones who are using the fareless transit. You know, there are a range of different ways in which residents can get involved, and we just welcome the opportunity to engage and to discuss it further.
Before we go into the audience questions, I want to add to Benji's earlier list about career paths, and that is that the nonprofit sector can also set you up for jobs in philanthropy. It was me working in the development department that prepared me to eventually become a program officer. You wield significant influence. You may not have the ultimate say depending on how the foundation is structured, but Adele touched on this earlier, and that is that we need more people with the right values in the right positions to influence not only the type of investments that are coming to our communities and our organizations, but also the longevity of those investments for sustainability and what's been touched upon here today. So we only have a few minutes left. We have a lot of great questions from the audience. So what we're going to do is we're going to do these rapid fire to get as many as possible. And I'm going to put a challenge out to the panelists. So you all take a deep breath and get ready for this. But we're going to go ahead and ask you the questions and ask you to keep your answers in under a minute so that we can get to as many of these as possible. And so Adele, the question here is from one of our guests. And the question is, where do you see South LA currently versus how it was after the 92 uprising? And is this a good or a bad time for South LA?
One, it's always a good time for South LA because of all of you on the call and all the community that's been in supporting and all the things that have happened at a national level to really uplift, you know, the Kerner report that came out in the early 1960s and some of the same recommendations that are here today are very, apparent in terms of what needs to happen. So one, I think going back to Zahira's point, there has been more, I think, outward resiliency in terms of continuously building South LA for the future. And I think we are at a place that we are facing some of the same challenges, but at least we're not afraid to talk about those challenges. And we're not afraid to address those challenges head on. Versus what I have experienced in the past where some of these things were closeted and not talked about. So those are those two things in particular for me.
Awesome. Zahira, would you please comment more on how you all approach creating apprenticeship opportunities and researching the jobs for the future?
In terms of researching the jobs of the future, that is really coming from governmental sources. So the county has a whole effort where they do a lot of research in terms of being able to understand what are these future pathways. So we call on and you know, leverage those resources to be able to understand, you know, what is happening next. You know, the other piece in terms of the apprenticeship programs is with partners like City Tech. So they are working on these types of programs all the time. And so this is something where Benny brought it as an opportunity for Slate Z and the various partners to work on. And so I think that that particular piece, and that's the benefit of the collaborative efforts, is that we're able to draw on the creativity and the genius of so many different people and so many different organizations, and then help to promote that through outreach and some other support to ensure that we're able to move the work forward.
Thank you. You're both doing really well, Benny. Well, we got to make sure you keep up with your other
panelists. I'm gonna try, brother.
This question is for all of you. We have a guest who decided to turn up the heat in here, and the question is: do all of your nonprofits today pay your employees a living wage in LA? That is $25 an hour or more. So I'm gonna. If you want to do a thumbs up for this one, or if there's any context you want to add to your yes or no question, Benny, I'll start with you.
Yeah, no, we do not have every employee making $25 an hour in our organization. We're working towards increasing salaries. Of course, I think our salaries are above the quote unquote market price for nonprofits. So I feel good about that. I feel good that the staff that we have is very skilled and knowledgeable, but we also have a lot of alumni from our programs that are part of our staff. So they're still developing their capacity and applying that in terms of their full-time employment.
You know, we're getting there. So we just recently completed our 3-year strategic plan. And as part of that, what we've established is an equity fund in our line item budget, that any excess amount of funding that we have goes automatically is used to bring up staff to be able to have a livable wage in South LA and to live in LA. So that is a commitment that I've made, that the board of directors has made, and that we've shared with staff.
Thank you for this question. I would say that for our permanent staff, yes. But we also have a number of AmeriCorps Vistas who are volunteers. And so no, in terms of that particular piece, that's in kind from the federal government, and the rate that they're paid is through AmeriCorps Vista. And it's something that, you know, that we're still working through and thinking through in terms of what does support look like, because I do believe that as we do this work, how do we model as much as possible what we want to see in the world by doing it within our own organizations? And so, I mean, you've heard these other kind of answers, and unfortunately, it's quite challenging because in order for us to do some of this work, we are calling on that piece in terms of our temporary staff who are volunteering their time with a stipend, but we still want to work on this piece because we do want to model what really is, you know, a best practice.
I will say that it's important to recognize that these stipend programs, these apprenticeship programs, make a tremendous difference in getting you on a pathway to make better salaries. So I'll tell you, South LA household incomes that I work with in the 9th Council District, $24,000 to $28,000. Public Allied Program pays you $22,000 for 10 months. It's doubling household incomes in South LA. It's sad to say, but an important step forward in terms of what we need.
I appreciate you all with the honesty and transparency on such an intimate question. And that transparency is absolutely needed. Zahira, not to pick on you, but an attendee, Francine Levine Grater from Laney, says that Laney manages two business improvement districts, or BIDs, in primarily low-income neighborhoods. How can small independent businesses get engaged and collaboratively supporting a strong local workforce?
It's a great question. I think the first step is to just join our efforts. So we have an entire work group that's focused on economic activity, which includes that economic activity in terms of small businesses. And we need people there who are doing exactly what is being done by the participant. Is if there are business districts that you are really doing work around, come join the conversation. And you'll hear from a number of different groups what are some of the pieces that they're doing right now that are best practices, and also how we can move forward. And then I would say also, you know, visit our website and some other resources, and we can share more in terms of what can be done. But this is really a comprehensive space to really to think through some of these issues. And we'd love to be in dialogue and conversation so that we can help in that progression and that journey that they're on.
Next, I'm going to bring it back to Adele again. What, in your opinion, will be the long-term impact of COVID-19 in South Los Angeles and its residents?
What we've seen from COVID is obviously some of the health inequities been exacerbated over, you know, generational trauma that's existed already in South LA. I'm an optimist. I'm hopeful. So one area that I think things have significantly changed is that prior to COVID, we could not provide telehealth services. And for some of our primary care, that's obviously changed. But honestly, our visits for behavioral health support have increased about 30 to 40 fold because people, you took out the stigma. People felt more comfortable to talk to a therapist mm-hmm. via video, via phone, video other support services. So we've seen this tremendous increase in building resiliency amongst our community for offering behavioral health support services through telehealth, which has been has really changed, especially access in South LA. We still have some issues of dealing with broadband access because I think there was an automatic assumption that everyone just had access to broadband if that was the case. And so we are working on those initiatives. And second, I think we have to understand just the long-term health impact of folks not seeking care during the pandemic and really understanding that folks should still seek care and that these opportunities are available. And I think third is just understanding that, you know, there is a workforce development pipeline here for community members if should they choose to go into healthcare careers, and community clinics like UMA and others in South LA are a wonderful place for them to enter the workforce, continue to build their educational skills, as Zahira said, and know that there are different levels that they can continue to rise from the beginning.
Thank you for that. Benny, how have your training programs at CD Tech shifted to people to prepare workers for the green economy?
Well, right now, I mean, like I said, most of our work related to, for example, our public ally apprenticeship program is really driven by what the nonprofits focus on. But our community planning and economic development program that we have at LA Trade Tech College is starting to develop curriculum to build, to understand the green economy in terms of from a planning and organizing perspective. And so over the next 2 to 3 years, we're hoping to build an institute that's going to provide community residents the opportunity to develop the skills, knowledge sets, and networks to enter that from a business development perspective. In other words, we want folks who know how to engage residents to understand how to start their own consulting groups so that they can generate the kind of resources that they need to collaborate with some of these private and public investments around the green economy. So that's tied more to the education and training side, but we also have an apprenticeship program for people to get placed at nonprofits and get and the money gets paid from the state. That's through our program at LA Trade Tech College. You know, I know it's rapid fire, so real quick. One of the things I was jealous that you asked Adele the question about South LA, Elmer, early. Look, South LA has a strong, strong cultural base of people that are proud to be from South Central. That's the big difference that's happened from 1992. The other thing is we've done a lot to build multiracial relationships and organizing opportunities. That's the other tremendous advantage that we've seen from 1992 forward. So I wanted to put that on the radar as well.
Great. I'm going to ask, we're down to two more questions, folks. I'm going to ask all of our panelists to answer this one because I think it's an excellent question that all of us have been grappling, especially during the pandemic, and that is resiliency. And our guest here articulated it really beautifully, saying that resiliency is exhausting. So what is the transformative opportunity in workforce development that provides respite and supports from having to always be resilient? Because you can't do it all the time. So I'm going to ask Zahira to take this question on first.
Wow. Thanks, Elmer. That's a big question. First, I'm going to first add to the Lainey question really quickly, and then I'll get to the resiliency piece, and I'll add to the Lainey question quickly. The other piece I would say in terms of helping small businesses, and this kind of also gets into this case of like resiliency, is planning for what's gonna happen for the future of that business. So there are some small businesses right now that are planning for the future of the business in terms of do the current workers take over that business, but what does that business look like so that we still have that business in place and how it continues to support workforce, also preparing for contracts for small businesses and ensuring your small businesses within your district are able to get some of those larger contracts, which means that there are certain supports that they need. They have to have certain insurance and certain types of training in order to go after some of those contracts, which are then going to help with the vital nature of their business and then also help with the workforce piece. You know, on the resiliency piece with workforce, I think that that one is really challenging and really tricky because I think resiliency, depending on how you're using it, is a little challenging and tricky. I think that all of us are resilient because we're here. That's sort of the nature of being resilient. And I think that oftentimes for low-income communities, like we don't need to learn how to be resilient. We've gone through a lot and we're still here. And so we've kind of figured out how to be resilient. I think that then the piece comes into like, how do you learn how to rest? And learning how to rest and learning what it means to step back takes a lot of vulnerability and a lot of honesty with everyone for them to understand that you do not have an endless supply of energy, that you need to rest. So the first thing I will say is that if you have sick leave and if you have vacation, make sure that your team actually takes it so that they are actually resting. And you know, people need to rest. And when they come back to you, they're so much more vibrant. They're so much more able to do work because they've had space to rest. Also figuring out ways to incorporate that same level of rejuvenation within your workday with your team. That may be occasionally having, an activity where it's a fun activity, or you're doing a lunch break with them, or you're looking at some of the different opportunities that now some of the hospitals are offering in terms of options to really think about wellness for your team. So they're giving, list of different opportunities in terms of how to think about wellness. But allowing people space to rest and not penalizing rest, but looking at it as part of the full compensation package is rest, and ensuring that your team actually takes the time to rest so that they can come back to you as more full, more complete people.
So here I hit it pretty square forward on the self-care wellness piece. You have to do it institutionally as well as really programmatically as well. You have to sometimes protect people from themselves, and you have to also assess your organization, that you have. Where are people? What are they comfortable with? What are they used to? In my organization, we have four different generations of experience, and so sometimes that's really challenging. The second thing I'd say is, this COVID situation and working from home has allowed us an opportunity, in my opinion, for people to be more present even with their families and feel some levels of comfort of being able to take care of some of the needs. So I feel like there's more trust with our staff because they've been able to still do their work, but at kind of the convenience and needs of their family and home issues, right? Working from home and taking care of their kids, having to figure things out, kind of has helped build a sense of trust, a larger trust. So when we come back, we might have to have different models of how we do our work, right? So I think that also helps people with in terms of feeling of connection in these tough times and going forward. I think the third thing is making sure we get more money from foundations to do things like retreats. I've been hearing of organizations who are going on retreats to Napa and to Cancun because why should we not give ourselves those opportunities to relax and get away from the grind just because we do nonprofit work or we do social justice work? We feel sometimes that we don't deserve taking care of ourselves in environments that we're not used to, right? And having moments to rest and engage with each other in a kind of social way. So these are things that I think have been important. And the last thing I'll say is nonprofits have to be more reflective internally. The workforce that's coming in, people who've had multiple barriers to employment, this younger generation, they have a different mindset in terms of what they see their role being or what their skills and sets need to be. Nonprofits have to look more internally about how are we doing a better job? What are we going to do to better support our younger employees? How do we make sure we communicate better? How do we make sure we train and professionally develop skills? And even how do we define what a healthy environment is in our workspaces? So these are the things that I think are critical.
I'll just add to that very quickly. The biggest thing for me is, in a, taking a sports analogy, is to build a bench. We got to build a bench for this work. One that's modeling behaviors that are resilient and supportive. And just as we know that trauma transcends into our blood and our DNA and can be transferred to generation, we also know that resiliency and the work we put into resiliency can be transferred to our generations to come. And to build a bench, to mentor, and to make sure there's leadership pipelines and leadership development opportunities, both at the board levels, at our organizational levels, and that we take on someone that we know can take the work into the future and, you know, give folks who've been at this 30, 40, 50 years, the wisdom and the space to share their lessons, absorb that, and create that new context of uplifting the next generation as you continue this work. And anything that's worth happening is not going to be achieved in our lifetime. And so we want to make sure that we leave the path forward for many generations to come.
Okay, with the last question, we're going to wrap it up. Benny, if we could include the how can we include the for-profit industries in supporting economic and workforce development and ensure that they are doing so in a culturally appropriate and community-centered way?
So you said, how do we get the private sector to jump on our bandwagon of trying to transform South LA in a positive way?
The forefront. Is that the question? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that the key thing is to demonstrate that for them to do well, they need to invest in the communities that are critical to their well-being. There's the whole concept of the triple bottom line, where the company does well, the people do well, and the community does well as part of that process. So I think we need to have certain conversation with some of these growth industry sectors, because it's important that we do. Because see, what happens is the public sector puts money out in the street, and then the private sector works around that. So Metro is building trains, so the private sector wants to benefit from that in terms of where they do development, right? So we have to have a conversation up front and talk about what we need to do collectively, right? What is the transition? How many people are they going to engage? I think we have to create mandates. If I can force a construction company to hire locally at a certain percentage rate, we got to do that with other private sector industries so that they can also be part and feel part of the responsibility to contribute benefit, but also give something back to the community. So I think it requires a lot of conversation, engagement, and putting some pressure. And as I said earlier, advocacy is key.
Well, thank you all so much. That does it for our webinar here today. This was a really great one. I really want to a big special thank you to all of our panelists. You all brought it with not only tremendous passion, but knowledge, and always uplifting South Los Angeles, which is near and dear to all of us here. And that's why we are doing this work. I want to thank all of our attendees for spending your afternoon with us. And the team that made it possible, to Jordan, Jesse, Noemi, and Jessica, thank you all for all of the work that you did to pick this webinar up and do all the logistics. And a special shout out to our interpreters here today, Vicky and Pilar. The guests don't get to see you, but we get to see them in the background, and they made sure that our guests receive the same information in Spanish. So thank you for the work that you do. Muchas gracias. And we hope that you have a great rest of your day. Goodbye.
Thank you, everybody.
This podcast is made possible by the generous investments of the California Endowment. The content is taken from the South LA Rooted Report, which is written by Laura Murata and Eric Watt in collaboration with Special Service for Groups Incorporated.
The show is produced at the Hood Digest Digilab. It's narrated by Marlo J. and Elmer Roldan. The theme music features original content from South Central Cartel's South Central Madness and original music produced by Rico Pavon. The podcast is produced by Daniel Castillo and Brian Aguilar. Our assistant producer is Nelly Arciniega.
Subscribe, share, comment, and like the South LA Rooted podcast on all platforms.